Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we dedicate our stories to elders, grandparents, and family members who came before us.
Some people called on the phone. What time is your appointment? Mine's 2:45. Our friend, the dentist, he was 3:30. And it was like a social event.
It's a small island. A lot of them I knew when I was a kid. So it was, you know, to really help them feel like they weren't alone.
It's partly this communal nature of food. And so it can operate as a bridge, not just between neighbors and friends, but also between the living and the dead.
Listen to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carlos Yescas, and today I'm your guest host. Today, I will be speaking with three amazing people. They are all involved with the Daphne Cephalus Teaching Endowment and are advocates for cheese education. We have Rachel Jewell, Mary Quick, and Peter Dixon. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Carlos. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you. Rachel, or Jewel, as her friends call her, has been with the organization since the beginning. She is the chief administrator. Mary and Peter serve now in the board of directors, and I am also in the board of directors of this wonderful organization. I decided to interview them today to show how we are working and the changes that we are making. For those of you not familiar with the Daphne Cephalus Teaching Endowment, we are a nonprofit educational organization that gives grants to expand cheese knowledge. We were set up based on the vision of cheese educator Daphne Cephalus. And since 2013, we have awarded 8 scholarships. Those scholarships that fund travel to Europe, and it is better known as the DCTA. Last year, because of the pandemic, we decided to wait on giving a traveling grant until the situation is more manageable, but still want to continue our work of creating educational resources for the cheese community. So we launched the DCRA. This research grant allows people to conduct research without traveling and creating a resource that will be used to educate cheese lovers. Applications are welcome until May 1st, 2021. You can see more information on our website. So without further ado, let me start with the conversation today with Mary Quick. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Carlos. Great to be here.
Mary is currently on the board, as I said. You have serving for a long time. Is that right, Mary? When did you start serving for at the board?
Oh, gosh, I think 3 years ago I started serving. So not nice. So very long.
Very good. And before joining the board, you were involved with the CTE, right? What was your involvement before joining?
Well, we had some recipients who came, rocked up at our farm, and we just learned so much from them. And I had met Daphne when she worked in New York, and I just wanted to be part of this amazing organization.
That's wonderful. So let me get right to the questions that we kind of have prepared. What is the one thing you have learned during a visit from one of our recipients that kind of has changed your way of thinking about cheese making, cheese education?
Well, I guess what we do every day with starters and rind, cows and feed, grazing, our make room and our store, you know, we tend to take all of that for granted. And these incredibly inquiring, passionate young people rock up and ask about everything and really point up things that we take for granted and are actually just extraordinary. I guess particularly about our rinds, how our rinds are formed and that natural microflora that creates our flavours, but also about our heritage starters, these amazing mixes of complex mix of microorganisms that makes the complexity of our flavours. And to have people coming and asking us about that, we suddenly realise that we're dealing with something special, and then we can start to think about it and play riffs on it and, yeah, just really celebrate and highlight it. So I've got that knowledge and understanding.
That's wonderful. That sounds wonderful. Yeah, no, definitely is. This is, you know, this has come up many times in our meetings, but it's one of those ways in which, you know, people kind of like, by having someone visiting and doing this kind of research, you start looking again, sort of in a new light, things you were doing before. So you have read 3 years of applications. So you must have seen a lot of applications. Do you remember any one application that was like so interesting? What topics were they were at the beginning that were sort of top of mind of everyone that maybe have disappeared? Have topics changed a lot? Can you tell us about sort of how you have read these 3 years of applications?
It's been such a joy. You've got these really interesting developed ideas for everything from, you know, affinage and starters and, you know, how traditional cheeses are made. But also you get, you know, could you do alpage? Could you do summer grazing in America? You know, how do we get cheese education out right out to every far corner of the country? So it's just feels like it's walking, you walk into a sort of garden full of flowers and there's just different flowers every year. And yes, of course, some themes, but there's just this amazing variety of topics turn up and you just want to roll around. And I'd like every one of them to be a recipient, but of course you have to choose one. It's so hard.
That sounds wonderful. I love that vision of like walking in and there being a lot of flowers with different ideas. Do you have any special sort of way that you read the applications? Do you wait until, you know, a Sunday afternoon to read them? Do you read them throughout the day? Do you have a drink or have a special meal before you do this?
Well, it's because it's a lot of reading that you're doing, and you really want to honour these applications which people have spent so much time on. So I tend to set aside two times where I've got, you know, a couple of hours each time, and I read them through once, and then I'll go back and read through them again. I'll make notes. I'll try and, you know, try and see, is this person actually going to be able to achieve this? And is this going to make? Are we going to make a teacher here? Because that was really what Daphne Zephos Teaching Awards is about. And just try and roll around in it and get to know them. And then I always get hold of Jewel and say, how am I going to make my mind up? This is so hard. And she said, oh, just do what you can. you know, just say what there is to say for you. So it's really difficult. They're amazing.
They're fun to read, and that sounds like you have a wonderful time, and also, you know, you take this very seriously. So do you think the DCTE awards are changing the industry? Do you think we are having kind of an organization and, of course, the recipients, an impact on traditional cheesemakers? How do you feel, you know, after being 3 years with the organization and more involved before that, how do you feel we're changing our industry?
Well, the vision that I've got is that, you know, right across the country, in every town, there would be an amazing cheese shop where you could get some of these extraordinary cheeses, or a farmer's market, but that we would also, with this cheese education, that's going to get out to everybody. So it's not just about the real elite cheeses, the really expensive cheeses, but this would enable everybody to understand where cheese comes from, you know, how great it is, the incredible variety of flavours that you can get from it. So it's difficult because I haven't been to the United States since COVID started, obviously. But that's what I feel will happen is that you have cheese teachers, and then there will be people who want to learn about cheese and understand about cheese. And it's that over time will and is changing our industry, both for, you know, at the top end, but also right the way through.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good way of thinking about it. Yeah, we're ready to have you back, Mary, and definitely appreciate your time. For folks that are listening, we are recording this in the afternoon in the United States. Mary is logging in from the UK. So we're going to let her go. And thank you, Mary, again. We are going to go for a break. And when we come back, we'll have Jewel and Peter.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I am Carlos Yescas, and today I'm your guest host. Today I'm talking with people engaged with the Daphne Cephas Teaching Endowment. Next, we have Jewel. You have been part of the DCTS since the beginning, and you have had a big role in guiding our recipients to successfully complete their research and travel. So you are in a unique position to share with applicants your experience, but also with the audience about what, you know, has been going on for so long. But let me start with a more sort of an educational note. I would love to hear from you. What is the one thing that you heard during a DCTA recipient presentation that you use in your everyday work?
I love this question because, yeah, I administer the award, but I really get to learn also. I love being able to have both sides of the coin as part of my experience. And I thought about this and I've learned so much, but something that my day job, for those who don't know, I work for Essex Street Cheese as the head of education and marketing. And so I'm constantly looking for ways to convey the stories or the histories behind our cheeses, how to help mongers practically sell cheese in a store environment or online or whatever it is. And so I'm always looking for inspiration of different ways to do things. And I really found that I will never forget this aha moment in Vince Raziunel's 2018 presentation. He won, he received the reward in 2017, and his goal was to travel to the United Kingdom and learn about cheddars, but really learn about cheeses in a way of how do we convey flavor profiles? Like, how do we actually communicate this? How do we explain it to mongers, but also in a way that is actually yielding sales instead of just kind of these nice flowery tasting notes that we share? And especially if they can't understand the words we're using. And so what this thing he did during his presentation in Pittsburgh at the American Cheese Society conference, he brought with us and passed around these cotton balls that he had stored in the Hafod cheddar storerooms for months. He went to Wales twice, and about 3 months break between each. And so he kept these cotton balls in these little vials in there for 3 months so that they could absorb like all the humidity and all the smells of that space. And then he sealed them and he brought them back. And that summer he presented it to us and he had us pass around, and we literally inhaled the smell of these cotton balls. And immediately it was just this completely three-dimensional sensory experience where everyone in the room could actually confirm that they were understanding what earthy meant. And while enjoying the cheese, right? Because we use these words, but like if you haven't smelled that before, or your definition might be different than the guy standing next to you, are you actually effectively communicating? And his point was that the American consumer, and sometimes even the monger, really struggles to understand the difference between British and North American cheddars. You know, there's a recipe difference, there's heritage and things, but when you can smell that environment, it just captured everything better than words ever could. Right? Like you can talk at someone forever, but once they smell it, then they got it. Right? And so it happened a year later. I had kind of been mulling around this idea, and he just gave me the tools of how to do it. And I ended up building a curriculum at Essex based on this idea of calibrating our palates during tasting cheeses by smelling 18 different vials of different ingredients, ranging from butter to croissants to wet wool to lemon peel to raw almonds and even fresh dirt. And what I have mongers do is I have them taste a cheese, write down everything that they taste, then smell the vials, and then taste the cheese again, writing down anything new or something actually more specific now that they can identify. They smelled it before, but they didn't know what the word was. It was like on the tip of their tongue. And so it was really fascinating to help a group of mongers unify their vocabulary. Because now when I say sheepy, but if you've never smelled wet wool, that descriptor is lost on you, right? But right. Now, because we passed around actually wool that I bought and dampened, we all like, yes, sheepy. That's what that means. And so it was just this incredible thing where Vince's presentation just opened my eyes to a new way of actually using like props to help calibrate our palates. And so that we're calibrating our vocabulary and we're just more effectively communicating flavor profiles to professionals, but also consumers. So that when someone comes into the shop and we're saying lemon curd and lemongrass or, you know, fresh sod, and this person's a New Yorker who's never smelled fresh sod before, you know, like that's really cool and eloquent, but it's not very effective, right? And so it was just, that's literally something that like I'll just never forget, just being, it personally impacted my job and how I teach and how I personally taste cheese also.
That's wonderful. I love all of that. And I have heard of this training that you do, and I know mm-hmm. that some of the cheesemongers get to do it at some of the events that are public, and I think it's a wonderful way to using that knowledge that, you know, like Mary was saying, has been built, and then, you know, when we have someone in your case, Vince, comes and highlights it, it becomes really the reality of the education that now we all use and are able to share with each other. Thank you so much for sharing that. Now I want to move more sort of the sort of hard questions of, you know, the award and, you know, the endowment. And as I said to our listeners, you know, you have been managing, you get to, you know, see everything that goes into the background. And I think you're the person that most people talk to when they're applying. And so I would like to start with, what are some of the common questions that you get for people looking to apply, that you know, we could help people thinking of applying, you know, how to help them navigate, you know, to be successful at getting one of these awards?
Yeah. So that definitely, there's a lot of questions, but the ones that really just come up every year are really two. How do I write a vision? it's the number one requirement to applying. And it's really a foreign concept to many. To some, it's incredibly natural because maybe they've done it personally or their business does a lot of visioning. So to some, it comes more easily. They have some exposure to it or they've read books about it. But others, literally, they've just never, ever used this tool before. And so it can be awkward. You have to write in the past tense and you have to flesh out this really descriptive idea of what you've accomplished because of receiving the award. And so they're just very stuck on actually how to write this out. And so what we usually do is we offer, you know, examples of the past recipients' visions that they've written, because that can help them see, okay, this was a successful vision that the board liked, give you an example of what it looked like, what kind of details to include, what kind of details maybe aren't as important. And yet they still feel really nervous because the questions are, well, what if I don't actually do the things that I write about? You know, will I be held accountable to that? The answer is no. and how do I know, in the sense of what, you know, I want to, a lot of people end up being too vague in their visions. And my thing is, be more detailed, really paint a picture of what it was like to be there. Who did you talk to? Where did you stay? What did it look like? And they get nervous about that, though, because they're like, well, what if I can't arrange that interview? And that's okay. That's, we're not going to hold you accountable to that because something could happen, something could change. But really, we want to convey that you've kind of done almost a little bit of research in advance, and you have this kind of idea of really what this could look like. And so then, but that still is always a struggle. So we recently did a great webinar, thanks to a contribution from the great guys at Zingtrain. And so that's available, information and tools, things like that. We hope to have that be a regular thing. We had about over 100 people join that, which was really awesome. And I think
that's a lot. Yeah.
And I think the feedback from that was, I'm very excited to see how that impacts applicants, just the number of people who apply, because now they know the tool. And I'd say the other thing, which kind of goes hand in hand, is, you know, well, what is the board looking for? And I always smile when people ask me that, because I'm like, you're not going to like my answer. because there's nothing specific, you know, like there just isn't. And but the two things they are that like catches a board member's attention is inspiration and something personal. So something that truly makes their heads turn and discover there's a need they hadn't even thought of before. I think of Ann Campbell's research to expand our definition of Mediterranean cheeses. And board members were like, holy crap, I've never thought we should do that. But yes, you're right. And so, yes, I want to support this vision. Or maybe they were aware of the need, but no one had actually kind of built a plan of how to address it. And I think of that in the case of Eric Meredith's research, that we knew that there's cheesemakers who struggle to get feedback. There's cheesemakers who struggle to be able to quantify flaws in their cheese. There's no real standard way to do that in the United States. However, France has an incredible system for that. And what if we could translate that over here? And so that was very something that resonated with the entire board, was like, oh, someone is willing to go and put in the work. And then the personal part of it. You know, our goal is that we're building teachers, like Mary said, but we're building teachers for a lifetime. And while we want to build teachers who can be well-versed in many things and just frankly be better teachers in anything they address, but we really hope that what they start with in their DZTA vision becomes a part of them, that they carry this on for the rest of their career. So when considering a subject, I just strongly encourage, choose something that you feel attached to, that's going to come through in your vision. That personal investment means that when we are going to give you this money, it's more likely that it's going to have a long-lasting impact if you really care about it, right? It's not going to be just this kind of passing interest for a couple months, and then all of a sudden in a couple years, you're no longer interested, you no longer want to talk about it. And that happens, right? We go through phases where we're super interested in one subject, but it's not really going to become our lifelong commitment. And I think of, you know, Jess Perry was our first inaugural recipient, and she was just a wonderful example of this, of writing about Basque shepherds. She saw them in her backyard in Utah. So this was something relevant to her, and she could see them, but also her mother grew up in the mountains. She spoke about that her mother, that's like in her blood, to be attached to like mountain horse riding people, you know, and she felt a pull to that lifestyle. And so we felt that. And even 8 years later, she's still very connected and personally passionate about this subject. And so that's what I like to encourage people, is write about something personal, something that we feel like even the years after you've received the reward, you received the money, you've taught, you've done the things, that you're still going to really care about this and want to even keep learning about it.
Right. No, that's all very good advice. And I totally agree with you that, you know, I have only read one sort of set of applications, and there were definitely, you know, great ideas that, you know, the people have done a lot of sort of preliminary research, but then I didn't feel that they were necessarily connected in a personal way. And so I was like, I don't know if that person is going to be able to do that later on, or is going to be willing to sort of do the investment of time. And so, of course, I personally end up choosing you know, something that the person felt more attached and sort of more personally committed to that. So that's wonderful to share with people listening. And so I, you know, I'm fascinated about this idea of things that were or not, or things that are right now, but in the future would probably not be anymore. And so I think that you have that sort of bird's eye point of view of this thing. And so what do you think are some of the topics that are becoming really important that maybe were sort of brought on because of the research of others, that maybe weren't at the beginning of, you know, when the endowment started? And, you know, how has that changed, do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, when this started over 8 years ago, there weren't that many scholarships available. So it was pretty groundbreaking, especially one with this much money that allowed you to travel to Europe.
Right.
That was unheard of, right? You had scholarships to go to conference, or you had scholarships, you know, to kind of do maybe the Comte Association scholarship, very specific, you know, things, internships. But this was really revolutionary in that you got to build your whole idea. And so the top, you know, what was really important then was just kind of giving the opportunity to cheese people, right? Just even offering this idea. And so we built a foundation. The organization was committed to fulfilling Daphne's dream. You know, we got the money. We had to raise money so that this could be something offered in perpetuity. There was a lot of logistics. And so the ideas were really important, the topics of research, but we really just were like, here's money, please take it. You know, please go pursue your dreams. And now what we're realizing 8 years later, that's still very important. But I think, you know, the industry is always changing and the needs of the industry are always changing. And I think that with the board we have for the last couple of years is very committed to making sure we stay the opposite of tone deaf. We stay tone sensitive to the needs of the industry. And what do mongers need? What do cheesemakers need right now? What does the public need right now? What needs to be raising awareness and kind of feeling a responsibility as an organization to honor that through the recipients who are then receiving the money? But then also, how are we giving back? You know, that this is also something that there's economic concerns, there's time constraints, how we've really become, instead of just an organization that has money, we give you a check, you go learn, and then we kind of have this disengaged relationship. It's almost like if you sign up to receive the DCTA, you're signing up to be kind of a lifer in our organization.
Right.
You know, like, we're not going to quit you. We're going to keep following up with you, and we're invested in your career, and we want to ensure your success. And I think that's that maintenance of those relationships, right? The beginning was just getting people to receive the award, just getting people to apply. And now it's like, wait, how can we make sure that this is sustainable, that they are feeling connected, that they are feeling that they can still continue this 7, 5, 4, 3, 2, however many years later? How can we make it more accessible to people? We've nailed, that's why I'm really excited about this research award, is that another concern that's always happened is, I'd love to, who doesn't want $5,000 to travel to Europe, but I've got kids and I've got a job or I've got a company and I can't travel. So again, how do we address the ability to give educational opportunities to people that actually fits their needs and their lifestyle and what they can do, while still giving back to the greater community of something that's relevant to the times.
Right. And so, this is kind of like the perfect segue to, you know, the fact that, you know, this award that we have is so different, right? That this mm-hmm. one, this new one doesn't require people to travel. Not that we don't want people to travel. Of course, we love that. But really is sort of focusing in now in, you know, maybe more nimble projects that can be done faster, and that we turn out that information, that those resources faster, so that the industry is really learning and that we are impacting that learning process. Thank you so much for that, Jewel. Next, we have Peter Dixon. Peter joined the board just last year. Am I right, Peter?
That's correct.
And so after your perspective... Yeah, so your perspective is so very different, you know, because you joined sort of like in the middle of the, you know, just before the craziness started of the pandemic, and you've been helping us sort of move forward with new ideas and plans. Let me just start with kind of the same question that I started with Mary. So what is the one thing that you have changed in your cheesemaking practice after hearing from one of the recipients? How has, you know, the sort of knowledge that has been created by the endowment sort of impacted your own work?
I was inspired by Sam Frank, his presentation on heritage breeds, to work with the farmer that we get our milk from, only one farm, one herd, to begin to find the means to bring heritage breeds into the herd so he could be either keeping the pure lines or crossbreeding, which I've noticed some other very good cheesemakers in the U.S. have done effectively to make great milk, to make a very fine raw milk cheese. So that was really the thing for me. And I continue to hold a very strong interest in that because I think these particular animals are very well adapted to the kind of marginal land that's great for pasture and for making special milk for the best cheese.
That's fascinating. So what type of animals did they have before, and what are the sort of heritage breeds that they're integrating now?
Yeah, well, they actually have Jerseys and Holsteins. This farm is a grazing farm, so for the past several decades, the cows have been going to pasture up to 3/4 of a mile distance from the barn, and they're very good cows for that. But I was inspired to go to the Charlevoix in Quebec to investigate the Canadian cows, because those are really the closest heritage breed to us, and they're cows that are specially adapted to a northern climate like we have here. So we're working on that angle, and we were just about to make some progress before the pandemic hit, so that's been put on the shelf. But in the meantime, a Dutch belted cow was given as a gift to the farm, so we do have one in there.
That's wonderful. Well, yeah. we look forward to tasting a cheese made with the Canadians as well. I know that there's a lot of research in Canada on that heritage breed. Now, sort of moving on to the sort of questions about the cheesemakers and how the information that we're creating and the resources that are being created by the recipients have impacted. Would you care to share which topics do you think suffer from the biggest misconceptions about cheesemakers and cheesemongers that maybe it will be good to sort of delve more into?
Yeah, I have the number one on my list that's always I've found very difficult here in the United States is the knowing the difference between raw and unpasteurized milk cheese. And I would love for some progress to be made on those lines so that we actually have a designation for raw milk cheese as it's done in Europe.
Okay, Peter, thank you for that. So last question, do you think cheesemakers have a responsibility to share their knowledge? And should they be compensating for sharing this knowledge? You know, this is kind of a question that has come up when applicants are thinking, is like, how, you know, they feel sometimes bad that they're going to go and stay with someone and they're shy that they're going to be, you know, requiring a lot of commitment from a cheesemaker. And so I just want to hear from sort of your end of what does it mean for a cheesemaker to sort of receive one of our recipients, and how should they be compensated if they should be?
Yeah, that's a very personal question, I think, in that it's really up to you have to think about human nature and the way people are in the world, and it's difficult to know that in advance, the way someone feels about that situation. Personally, I always enjoy the experience of having someone who's involved in cheese come and work with me and spend time learning about what I do. But on the other hand, I have people that request different kinds of advice from me. You know, I work as a consultant. And so there's this line of where is the line, is the question. And that's really my best answer. I think it's a very personal question.
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. And I think one that I wanted to include, mostly because I know that if people are listening to this, that may be applying, that, you know, there is nothing set in stone. And I think a part of what we're trying to do, and you could help us here as well, is that we would help you to try to figure out what is the best way to approach a host, what is the best way to sort of have maybe that conversation, and what is your contribution? Jewel, you have anything to share on that sort of very big topic?
Yeah, no, it's a really critical thing, and it ties back to also, if, you know, once you receive the award, you're not alone to figure all this out. And I think that's a really, I appreciate that you brought that up, Carlos, because, you know, you have these ideas of who you're going to go visit, but maybe you've only heard of them. You don't even know their email address. You don't have a rapport with them. You know, we try to create a board that's diverse in relationships also to help bridge those gaps and to kind of, for lack of a better word, vouch for the credibility of our recipients, so that when they are calling up, quote unquote, a cheesemaker or an affineur, it's not just some blind person that they may say no to, right? Is this worth their time? And so then when it comes to those things, you know, we also look at, that's when you receive the monies for whatever it is, for the research award or for the traveling award, the teaching award, you know, that money is, we don't require receipts. So we can figure out what's the best way to use that. Does that mean sometimes you do need to pay for some sort of, like, you know, consulting interview with somebody, or access to libraries, or access to, you know, just personal information, research and things like that. But then when it comes to being on the road, yeah, is there some way that, I know Sam Frank actually is kind of a really wonderful one who stretched every cent that he had by visiting lots of them, but he volunteered to work. You know, sometimes it was that. It was kind of almost like an unpaid internship where he went, but he was also a contributing person on the farm. He contributed in that way, so that it was a sort of compensation in those terms. But we can help figure that out and figure out the best way to use your funds. And what I can say is that with the example of something like this, with our relationships in the DZTA, we haven't really run into a problem where cheesemakers are hesitant to have someone come for their time. They are very excited because, I mean, sure, as Peter can say, you want to share what you know because it improves the greater industry, right? It also is great advertising for your own cheese, right? So it's kind of awesome that someone's willing to show up and learn about it themselves and take their own time and do those kind of things, and it will pay off in the future. So, but if ever it does come up where it does feel like you need to have some sort of funds to, yeah, pay a consulting fee or pay for access, something like that, we at our end on the board, and myself as the administrator, can help navigate that. So that doesn't need to be an added stressor for an applicant. We can help you navigate those dynamics.
Deep and its connections in the artisan and traditional type mm-hmm. of cheesemaking community that a lot of the research is geared towards what people want to do. And so it creates a more of a good bet on a situation. That's another way we can help as well. But I do think, you know, in honor of Daphne, she was such a generous person. I mean, if we had a longer show, I would love mm-hmm. to just tell stories about Daphne, and I could tell a couple that it's really, that's where you just said, Jewel, that it's about this camaraderie and the genuine aspiration to share knowledge and just spread around the goodwill. And I think that's what the Daphne Zepp was teaching, and endowment has at its heart.
Right. Thank you so much, the two of you. This has been wonderful. I hope that so many people are encouraged to apply, and you know, they let their imaginations run wild and send wonderful applications. I know that I'm looking forward to reading the applications. I think that the pandemic will spark different ideas, and I'm interested to see what is that people that are in different parts of the industry are thinking about the future. And so I thank you both for sharing with me today and with our listeners.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carlos and Peter. It's a privilege to be able to serve with you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. This is Carlos Yescas, your guest host. I'll be back next season with new stories and exciting locations. Stay tuned. And thank you to all the folks at the Heritage Radio Network, especially Amanda today, who is our engineer and made this recording possible. Thank you. Bye.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Thanks for listening.